Welcome to episode 2, Munchies.
You say that like we have a loyal following, not a couple loved ones that we roped into listening to this podcast.
Hey, I'll have you know that I have had at least one passing acquaintance tell me that he liked the show.
How do you hear about it?
Well, so like 2 years ago, I went on one date with him one time, and then I randomly Facebook messaged him recently to send him the link unsolicited. He was really nice about it, actually.
Right.
Hey, it's a true story. Also, funny story. We could have totally Googled Literary Lunch Podcast before we, like, named this operation. But we decided that this was, in fact, a task for after our first episode, and there is already a Literary Lunch Podcast in existence.
Yes, my friends, we are professionals. Luckily for us, the other show hasn't put out an episode in a couple of years.
That means we win by default, right?
Not a competition, V.
Not with that attitude.
I also, if I recall, specifically said in the last episode that there would be no erotica. And yet...
It was my choice, and it's literary erotica, okay?
And yet, V decided that there is, in fact, going to be erotica, so clearly just ignore everything we say.
For this week, we are going to be talking about The Husband Stitch by Carmen Maria Machado. Let's do a lightning round review.
Erotica, romance, and horror.
All tied together very beautifully.
The husband is such a brat about her boundaries.
Makes me want to shake a can of pennies in his face.
Why does she need to finish herself off every time, though?
Because men!
Hashtag feminism?
We think yes. Well written and meaningful. And now, for the synopsis. Our protagonist gives generously of herself to the man who becomes her husband. She devotes her life to him, and they enjoy a full sex life. She has only one rule. He cannot touch the ribbon around her neck.
Over the course of their life together, she ruminates on the way stories shape our understanding of the world, and we see her husband again and again fight the one boundary she set. The ultimate tragedy of the story is that her husband is not a bad man, and yet he wants nothing more in life, after nearly 2 decades together, than to violate her.
Now for the discussion.
So we have a lot of things to say about this story, all of them good, by the way. One of the more interesting things to me in this story is the character of the husband, more specifically his relationship to the protagonist. I think I see a lot of people doing weird discourse about how sex scenes are never important to character development, and they're just there because you're horny. And I challenge anybody who thinks that to read this story, because boy, oh boy, does it prove them wrong.
It is one of the ways that they connect.
And it reflects how far she's willing to go for him, and also just how intent he is on violating her one stated boundary.
The sex scenes characterize him as intensely greedy. In fact, the thing that really got me up in my feelings was that right before he asked to and got the final permission to untie her ribbon, she says that she made the right choice of man. And she believes that. And it's, again, that he's not a bad man, but this is just the ultimate betrayal.
Yeah. And he even passes on his toxicity to their son. Like, for example, early on when her son is young, she says, "My son touches my ribbon, but never in a way that makes me afraid. He thinks of it as a part of me, and he treats it no differently than he would an ear or finger." But later, their son happens to witness a moment where the father tries really hard to get her to let him untie her ribbon, and is really mad when she won't let him. And then she says, "The next day, our son touches my throat and asks about my ribbon. He tries to pull at it, and though it pains me, I have to make it forbidden to him. When he reaches for it, I shake a can of pennies. It shakes discordantly, and he withdraws and weeps. Something is lost between us, and I never find it again."
That breaks my heart.
Honestly, it's such a bummer.
It's a symbol of her autonomy.
Yes!
It's a symbol of her personhood and her womanhood. When he unwraps that ribbon, he disrespects all of that, and she comes apart completely.
Yeah, literally comes apart.
Oh my god, that ending just had me shocked. Beth knew the urban legend of this neck ribbon thing, before reading the story, and she was able to sort of call it at the beginning. I had never heard of this, so when I got to the end, it was just mind-blowing that this could happen. Beth, how was your experience, given the fact that you knew?
For me, it was kind of the opposite because, you know, I've heard that urban legend or ghost story or what have you. I was like, I know where this is going. I know where this is going. And it just built up this horrible sense of dread all through the story as he kept trying to take it off. And I'm like, oh my God, I know what's going to happen if he takes off her ribbon. And it really made me get this like tense atmosphere going. It was so well done. Sort of the folklore I grew up with prepared me for that. Sort of like how in the story, folklore teaches lessons, good and bad, and informs women of the stories they occupy in the world. It can help us make sense of the world, but it can also just put us in our place.
There's a lot of different sort of lessons that Beth and I have compiled from what we have learned from this story and the stories within the story, which is just so well crafted.
So in the first category, we have stories of women being punished or meeting bad ends because they transgress the bounds of what's expected of them. For example, I once heard a story about a girl who requested something so vile from her paramour that he told her family and they had her hauled off to a sanatorium. I don't know what deviant pleasure she asked for, though I desperately wish I did. What magical thing could you want so badly? They take you away from the known world for wanting it.
That's gotta be oral, right?
You know, one must assume it's gotta be oral.
Oh man, take me away.
There's also the story of the bride in the trunk. As she says, brides never fare well in stories. Stories can sense happiness and snuff it out like a candle.
It's not even just women who transgress from society. It's women who do what they're supposed to do and, I don't know, supposed to do and get married. They still don't do well. Just women in stories get punished. They meet bad ends.
Right, because the thing they did wrong was being a woman, am I right?
Yes, and yet they are fearless anyway. My favorite quote from the story is, I have heard all the stories about girls like me, and I am unafraid to make more of them.
Yes, it's so good.
For example, the story in the graveyard, it says, afterward, everyone believed that she had wished to die, even though she had died proving she wanted to live. As it turns out, being right was the third and worst mistake. She was fearless.
And then there's parts where the author talks about the nature of stories and what lessons they impart upon us. As in, there's a story about a woman who heard a story about a woman who birthed wolf cubs in secret. When you think about it, stories have this way of running together like raindrops in a pond. Each is born from the clouds separate, but once they have come together, there is no way to tell them apart.
And I think that the stories in the story interact in that way, is they're all just drops in a bucket, and the bucket is just this collection of water of what it means to be a woman, of all the horrible and wonderful things that it means to inhabit the body of a woman.
One of the central themes, really, of the main narrative itself, which is women sacrificing for men. Okay, so this is the creepiest thing ever. She tells the story about a woman who is really being abused by her husband, and he one day brings her liver to cook, and I guess the dog ate it or something happens to liver and she doesn't have it anymore, and she knows she has to cook it for him or else things are going to go really badly for her. So she sneaks off to the church and she carves the liver out of the body of a dead woman and brings it back and gives it to him to eat. And then, in the night, she comes to a horrifying realization. Then she saw the face of the dead woman and recognized her own mouth and eyes. She looked down at her abdomen, remembering now how she carved into her belly. She bled freely there in the bed, whispering something over and over as she died, something you and I will never be privy to. Next to her, as the blood seeped into the very heart of the mattress, her husband slumbered on. That may not be the version of the story you're familiar with, but I assure you, it's the one you need to know.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah.
And then there's also the story where the woman's hooking up with this guy and he wants to keep hooking up with her despite the fact that there's like a psychopath released on the streets. And then she sees this guy in the car window because they stay there. And it's like all these stories tell of how women relate to men in this world. I think it's interesting that the horror stories are closer to the truth than the fairy tales.
So then I tell him the story is closer to true. Children who go missing along a particular stretch of railroad track, lured by the sound of a phantom train to parts unknown. A black dog that appears at a person's doorstep 3 days before her passing. A trio of frogs that corner you in the marshlands and tell you your fortune for a price. My husband, I think, would forbid these stories, but my son listens to them with solemnity and keeps them to himself. But what's interesting is that, thinking about it, the further back in history you go, the closer fairy tales are to horror stories. For example, in the original ending of Little Red Riding Hood, she and her grandmother both get eaten by the wolf, and then a woodsman hacks the wolf into pieces so they can come out of his stomach. And Hansel and Gretel, I'm sure you guys remember, quite literally burn a witch alive so she won't eat them. Like, old fairy stories are pretty darn creepy in themselves. And they serve a pretty similar purpose to the urban legends that the author peppers throughout this book. This purpose of warning you what behavior to stay away from, or else you'll receive a really big, outsized punishment for your quote-unquote crime.
So what are we rating this, Beth?
Oh, this is definitely 5 sandwiches out of 5 for me. It was such a good read, like so literary and so poignant. And it was just a joy to read. Highly recommend. Sorry, I'll stop raving now.
I agree 100%. That's it for today.
Yeah, next time we'll be reading The Grown-Up by Gillian Flynn.
Follow us on Twitter at LitLunchCast. Email us at litlunchpodcast@gmail.com or find us on our website, literarylunchpodcast.wordpress.com. Very fancy domain name.
We want to hear your thoughts, feelings, and reactions to this story and the next one. And depending on when you at us, you may even get a shout out in our next episode.
Bye, munchies!